Without any technical apparatus or calculations for prediction, homing pigeons can return to their roosts from long distances away. Migrant birds can revisit the same locations year after year, and plants can devise wonderful contraptions for distributing their seeds on the wind. They do not, of course, do these things on purpose, which is only to say that they do not plan and think them out. If they could talk, they could no more explain how it is done than the average man can explain how his heart beats. The instruments which achieve these feats are, indeed, organs and processes of the body, that is to say, of a mysterious pattern of movement which we do not really understand and cannot actually define. In general, however, human beings have ceased to develop the instruments of the body. More and more we try to effect an adaptation to life by means of external gadgets and attempt to solve our problems by conscious thinking rather than unconscious know-how. This is much less to our advantage than we like to suppose. There are, for instance, primitive women who can deliver themselves of a child while working out in the fields, and after doing the few things necessary to see that the baby is safe, warm, and comfortable, resume their work as before. On the other hand, the civilized woman has to be moved to a complicated hospital, and there, surrounded by doctors, nurses, and innumerable gadgets, force the poor thing into the world with prolonged contortions and excruciating pains. It is true that antiseptic conditions prevent many mothers and babies from dying, but why can't we have the antiseptic conditions and the natural, easy way of birth? The answer to this, and many similar questions, is that we have been taught to neglect, despise, and violate our bodies, and to put all faith in our brains. Indeed, the special disease of civilized man might be described as a block or schism between his brain, specifically the cortex, and the rest of his body. This corresponds to the split between I and me, man and nature, and to the confusion of Ouroboros, the mixed-up snake who does not know that his tail belongs with his head. Happily, there have in recent years been at least two scientists who have called attention to this schism, namely Lancelot Law White and Trigant Burrow. White caused this disease the European dissociation, not because it is peculiar to European-American civilization, but because it is specially characteristic of it. Both White and Burrow have given a clinical description or diagnosis of the schism, the details of which need not detain us here. It is simply saying in medical language that we have allowed brain thinking to develop and dominate our lives out of all proportion to instinctual wisdom, which we are allowing to slump into atrophy. As a consequence, we are at war within ourselves, the brain desiring things which the body does not want, and the body desiring things which the brain does not allow. The brain giving directions which the body will not follow, and the body giving impulses which the brain cannot understand. In one way or another, civilized man agrees with St. Francis in thinking of the body as brother ass. But even theologians have recognized that the source of evil and stupidity lies not in the physical organism as a whole, but in the cut-off, dissociated brain, which they term the will. When we compare human with animal desire, we find many extraordinary differences. The animal tends to eat with his stomach and the man with his brain. When the animal's stomach is full, he stops eating, but the man is never sure when to stop. When he has eaten as much as his belly can take, he still feels empty. He still feels an urge for further gratification. This is largely due to anxiety, to the knowledge that a constant supply of food is uncertain. Therefore, eat as much as you can while you can. It is due also to the knowledge that in an insecure world, pleasure is uncertain. Therefore, the immediate pleasure of eating must be exploited to the full, even though it does violence to the digestion. Human desire tends to be insatiable. We are so anxious for pleasure that we can never get enough of it. We stimulate our sense organs until they become insensitive, so that if pleasure is to continue, they must have stronger and stronger stimulants. In self-defense, the body gets ill from the strain, but the brain wants to go on and on. The brain is in pursuit of happiness, and because the brain is much more concerned about the future than the present, it conceives happiness as the guarantee of an indefinitely long future of pleasures. Yet the brain also knows that it does not have an indefinitely long future, so that, to be happy, it must try to crowd all the pleasures of paradise and eternity into the span of a few years. This is why modern civilization is, in almost every respect, a vicious circle. It is insatiably hungry because its way of life condemns it to perpetual frustration. As we have seen, the root of this frustration is that we live for the future, and the future is an abstraction, a rational inference from experience which exists only for the brain. The primary consciousness, the basic mind which knows reality rather than ideas about it, does not know the future. It lives completely in the present and perceives nothing more than what is at this moment. The ingenious brain, however, looks at that part of present experience called memory, and by studying it, is able to make predictions. These predictions are relatively so accurate and reliable, for example, everyone will die, that the future assumes a high degree of reality, so high that the present loses its value. But the future is still not here, and cannot become a part of experienced reality until it is present. Since what we know of the future is made up of purely abstract and logical elements, inferences, guesses, deductions, it cannot be eaten, felt, smelled, seen, heard, or otherwise enjoyed. To pursue it is to pursue a constantly retreating phantom, and the faster you chase it, the faster it runs ahead. This is why all the affairs of civilization are rushed, why hardly anyone enjoys what he has and is forever seeking more and more. Happiness, then, will consist not of solid and substantial realities, but of such abstract and superficial things as promises, hopes, and assurances. Thus, the brainy economy designed to produce this happiness is a fantastic vicious circle, which must either manufacture more and more pleasures or collapse, providing a constant titillation of the ears, eyes, and nerve ends with the incessant streams of almost inescapable noise and visual distractions. The perfect subject for the aims of this economy is the person who continuously itches his ears with the radio, preferably using the portable kind which can go with him at all hours and in all places. His eyes flit without rest from television screen to newspaper to magazine, keeping him in a sort of orgasm without release through a series of teasing glimpses of shiny automobiles, shiny female bodies, and other sensuous surfaces, interspersed with such restorers of sensitivity, shock treatments, as human interest shots of criminals, mangled bodies, wrecked airplanes, prize fights, and burning buildings. The literature or discourse that goes along with this is similarly manufactured to tease without satisfaction, to replace every partial gratification with a new desire. For this stream of stimulants is designed to produce cravings for more and more of the same, though louder and faster, and these cravings drive us to do work which is of no interest save for the money it pays, to buy more lavish radios, sleeker automobiles, glossier magazines, and better television sets, all of which will somehow conspire to persuade us that happiness lies just around the corner if we will buy one more. Despite the immense hubbub and nervous strain, we are convinced that sleep is a waste of valuable time and continue to chase these fantasies far into the night. Animals spend much of their time dozing and idling pleasantly, but because life is short, human beings must cram into the years the highest possible amount of consciousness, alertness, and chronic insomnia so as to be sure not to miss the last fragment of startling pleasure. It isn't that the people who submit to this kind of thing are immoral. It isn't that the people who provide it are wicked exploiters. Most of them are of the same mind as the exploited, if only on a more expensive horse in this sorry go-round. The real trouble is that they are all totally frustrated, for trying to please the brain is like trying to drink through your ears. Thus they are increasingly incapable of real pleasure, insensitive to the most acute and subtle joys of life, which are in fact extremely common and simple. The vague, nebulous, and insatiable character of brainy desire makes it particularly hard to come down to earth, to be material and real. Generally speaking, the civilized man does not know what he wants. He works for success, fame, a happy marriage, fun, to help other people, or to be a real person. But these are not real wants because they are not actual things. They are the byproducts, the flavors and atmospheres of real things, shadows which have no existence apart from some substance. Money is the perfect symbol of all such desires, being a mere symbol of real wealth, and to make it one's goal is the most blatant example of confusing measurements with reality. It is therefore far from correct to say that modern civilization is materialistic, that is, if a materialist is a person who loves matter. The brainy modern loves not matter, but measures, no solids, but surfaces. He drinks for the percentage of alcohol, spirit, and not for the body and taste of the liquid. He builds to put up an impressive front rather than to provide a space for living. Therefore, he tends to put up structures which appear from the outside to be baronial mansions, but are inwardly warrens. The individual living units in these warrens are designed less for living as for creating an impression. The main space is devoted to a living room of proportions suitable to a large house, while such essential spaces for living, rather than mere entertaining, as the kitchen, are reduced to small closets where one can hardly move, much less cook. Consequently, these wretched little galleys provide fare which is chiefly gaseous, cocktails and appetizers, rather than honest meals. Because we all want to be ladies and gentlemen and look as if we had servants, we do not soil our hands with growing and cooking real food. Instead, we buy products designed for front and appearance, rather than content. Immense and tasteless fruit, bread which is little more than a light froth, wine faked with chemicals, and vegetables flavored with the arid concoctions of test tubes which render them so much impressive pulp. One might suppose that the most outright example of civilized man's beastliness and animality is his passion for sex, but in fact there is almost nothing beastly or animal about it. Animals have sexual intercourse when they feel like it, which is usually in some sort of rhythmic pattern. Between whiles, it does not interest them. But of all pleasures, sex is the one which the civilized man pursues with the greatest anxiety. That the craving is brainy rather than bodily is shown by the common impotence of the male when he comes to the act, his brain pursuing what his genes do not at the moment desire. This confuses him hopelessly, because he simply cannot understand not wanting the great delicacy of sex when it is available. He has been hankering after it for hours and days on end, but when the reality appears, his body will not cooperate. As in eating, his eyes are bigger than his stomach. So in love, he judges woman by standards that are largely visual and cerebral, rather than sexual and visceral. He is attracted to his partner by the surface gloss, by the film on the skin, rather than the real body. He wants something with a bone structure like a boy's, which is supposed to support the exterior curves and smooth undulations of femininity, not a woman, but an inflated rubber dream. The function of sex itself remains, however, so much in the domain of instinctual wisdom that little can be done to increase its already intense pleasure, to make it faster, fancier, and more frequent. The only means of exploiting it is through cerebral fantasy, through surrounding it with coquetry, and suggestions of unspecified delights to come, as if a more ecstatic embrace could always be arranged through surface alterations. A particularly significant example of brain against body, or measures against matter, is urban man's total slavery to clocks. A clock is a convenient device for arranging to meet a friend, or for helping people to do things together, although things of this kind happened long before they were invented. Clocks should not be smashed. They should simply be kept in their place. And they are very much out of place when we try to adapt our biological rhythms of eating, sleeping, evacuation, working, and relaxing to their uniform circular rotation. Our slavery to these mechanical drill masters has gone so far, and our whole culture is so involved with it, that reform is a forlorn hope. Without them, civilization would collapse entirely. A less brainy culture would learn to synchronize its body rhythms rather than its clocks. The capacity of the brain to foresee the future has much to do with the fear of death. One knows of many people who would have said, with Stevenson, "Under the wide and starry sky, dig me a grave and let me lie. Glad did I live and gladly die, and I laid me down with a will." For when the body is worn out and the brain is tired, the whole organism welcomes death. But it is difficult to understand how death can be welcome when you are young and strong, so that you come to regard it as a dread and terrible event. For the brain, in its immaterial way, looks into the future and conceives it a good to go on and on forever, not realizing that its own material would at last find the process intolerably tiresome. Not taking this into account, the brain fails to see that, being itself material and subject to change, its desires will change, and a time will come when death will be good. On a bright morning, after a good night's rest, you do not want to go to sleep. But after a hard day's work, the sensation of dropping into unconsciousness is extraordinarily pleasant. Unfortunately, not very many of us die peacefully. We die through accidents and painful diseases, and it is tragic indeed when a person whose mind is still young and alert struggles uselessly with a dying body. I am sure, however, that the body dies because it wants to. It finds it beyond its power to resist the disease or to mend the injury, and so, tired out with the struggle, turns to death. If the consciousness were more sensitive to the feelings and impulses of the whole organism, it would share this desire, and indeed, sometimes does so. We come close to it when, in serious sickness, we would just as soon die, though sometimes we survive, either because medical treatment reinvigorates the body, or because there are still unconscious forces in the organism which are able to heal. Accustomed, as it is, to think of man as a dualism of mind and body, and to regard the former as sensible and the latter as a dumb animal, our culture is an affront to the wisdom of nature, and a ruinous exploitation of the human organism as a whole. We are perpetually frustrated, because the verbal and abstract thinking of the brain gives the false impression of being able to cut loose from all finite limitations. It forgets that an infinity of anything is not a reality, but an abstract concept, and persuades us that we desire this fantasy as a real goal of living. The externalized symbol of this way of thinking is that almost entirely rational and inorganic object, the machine, which gives us the sense of being able to approach infinity. For the machine can submit to strains far beyond the capacity of the body and to monotonous rhythms, which the human being could never stand. Useful as it would be as a tool and a servant, we worship its rationality, its efficiency, and its power to abolish limitations of time and space, and thus permit it to regulate our lives. Thus the working inhabitants of a modern city are people who live inside a machine to be batted around by its wheels. They spend their days in activities which largely boil down to counting and measuring, living in a world of rationalized abstraction which has little relation to, or harmony with, the great biological rhythms and processes. As a matter of fact, mental activities of this kind can now be done far more efficiently by machines than by men, so much so that, in a not-too-distant future, the human brain may be an obsolete mechanism for logical calculation. Already, the human computer is widely displaced by mechanical and electrical computers of far greater speed and efficiency. If, then, man's principal asset and value is his brain and his ability to calculate, he will become an unsaleable commodity in an era when the mechanical operation of reasoning can be done more effectively by machines. Already, man uses innumerable gadgets to displace the work done by bodily organs in the animals, and it would surely be in line with this tendency to externalize the reasoning functions of the brain, and thus hand over the government of life to electromagnetic monsters. In other words, the interests and goals of rationality are not those of man as a whole organism. If we are to continue to live for the future, and to make the chief work of the mind prediction and calculation, man must eventually become a parasitic appendage to a mass of clockwork. There is, indeed, a viewpoint from which this rationalization of life is not rational. The brain is clever enough to see the vicious circle which it has made for itself, but it can do nothing about it. Seeing that it is unreasonable to worry does not stop worrying. Rather, you worry the more at being unreasonable. It is unreasonable to wage a modern war, in which everybody loses. Neither side actually wants a war, and yet, because we live in a vicious circle, we start the war to prevent the other side from starting first. We arm ourselves, knowing that if we do not, the other side will, which is quite true, because if we do not arm, the other side will do so to gain its advantage without actually fighting. From this rational point of view, we find ourselves in the dilemma of St. Paul. To will is present with me, but how to perform that which is good, I find not. For the good that I would, I do not. But this is not, as St. Paul supposed, because the will or the spirit is reasonable and the flesh perverse. It is because a house divided against itself cannot stand. The whole organism is perverse, because the brain is split from the belly and the head unconscious of its union with the tail. There are few grounds for hoping that, in any immediate future, there will be any recovery of social sanity.